Hello, everybody, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to
Forget About It on Radio Region.
We are your hosts, Saima,
Samir,
my name is
Dayam, and I'm Rebel.
And let's just jam out for a bit. So hello everybody, welcome back, or welcome back to Forget About It on Radio Regent. Right before we begin, we want to do a land acknowledgement.
It is necessary to acknowledge that we stand on colonized land. We recognize that the purchase of the land that became Toronto was a deceitful and dishonest transaction. We recognize that the colonial power over these lands is built on murder, and that Toronto's name originated from the Mohawk Nation. Regent Park specifically is situated upon Haudenosaunee territory, where the Ojibwa language is spoken and where Treaty 13 was made to cover. As settlers, it is our responsibility to acknowledge the true history of the land we are situated upon to ensure that Indigenous history is not erased.
How is everyone? How are y'all feeling, guys?
What's going on? How was your weekend?
Yeah, how was your guys' weekend?
My weekend was amazing. Yeah. I did a lot. Guys, I went to Wonderland on Sunday.
Oh, really? How was that?
It was great. See, I'm not a really big ride fan, but you know, my friends made me, and I'd say I recommend everyone who's listening to go to Wonderland.
I remember I'd never been to Wonderland, and then I think 2 years ago, my friends convinced me, and it was insane because we went on the Leviathan a good six times.
For no reason.
We just kept going on it.
It's so nerve-wracking each time, right?
Yeah. But the Leviathan is fun because it's not, like, painful. Like, the Behemoth, you're in the air half the time because it's up and down.
Behemoth is so fun. I love that one.
The Behemoth sucks. I mean, I love it, but it sucks.
I love how you can never get used to it.
Like, no.
Yeah, that's a good thing.
Every time.
Yeah.
Like, and I remember when I started going, I would get so scared to a point where I would just get quiet, and I wouldn't even be enjoying it. I'd just be holding tight, praying to God that I'd be okay. Like, when is this gonna be over?
Yeah.
I remember, you know how whenever you go on a roller coaster, the pictures afterwards are always mad expensive.
Yeah, facts. Mm-hmm. They make you buy it.
Yeah, I remember when we went, we happened to know the person who was working there, so we got them for free.
You got them for free?
Yeah, because we happened to, the person working there knew my friend's older sister. So, because of that, we got the pictures for free. When I tell you, it's the funniest thing in the world.
That's so lucky because they're so expensive.
Yeah, but it's mid-scream. It's absolutely hilarious. I'll say this, though, about Wonderland. The one ride I refuse to go on is...
The Yukon Strength.
The Yukon is so fun. I promise you.
Because it's like a 90-degree drop. That then goes underground like three times.
I rode that, and honestly, I can say that I was really scared at the beginning because of the 90-degree drop, the underground part. But when you're riding it, it's actually really enjoyable.
Really?
Like, I would say the Behemoth is scarier than Yukon.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I mean, the Behemoth, because you're in the air half the time.
Yeah, that's true.
And the thing about Yukon, too, is when you're in the sky, like, they just pause it for a second.
Oh. Yeah. And it's like that drop is like 90 degrees. It's steep, man.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah. And do you guys know that one? I forget what it's called. It's pretty small, but it starts backwards.
Yes. Is that the bat one?
Yeah, the bat. That one made me vomit. That one was the worst.
Yeah,
that was the worst experience of my life.
Literally. And they have one. It bangs your head side to side, left to right.
The weird ones are...
I hate those ones. Do you guys like the water rides?
Those are the only good ones.
Yeah,
those are really fun.
Calm, not scary.
You don't know those water ones? The ones where they splash you with the water.
Do they still have those
I
open?
Think so. Like the logs. Yeah, they have one. They have like a water theme thing in Wonderland. Yeah.
Was it still packed? I know like they have to have a limited amount of people
because of COVID. So like it was recommended that you don't go in and out because there's like a long wait. It's like a 6 hour wait if you leave and then you try and come back in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I guess no lunch break. Just buy food. Buy food inside, you know?
Yeah. Exactly. So now we'll just jump right into it. So a little bit of an introduction on this topic for this week's radio show. We're going to be talking about Indigenous issues in Canada. But before we begin our interviews, we wanted to do a little bit of a history and how it affects the present. and talk about the history of colonialism and the treaties that make up Canada.
So the histories of colonialism in Canada begins with the fact that initially there were around 2 million Indigenous people already living here in the 16th century. Indigenous people had created an organized civilization with societies, diverse languages and cultures, a system of self-governance, and most importantly, a way of life. When colonizers migrated to Canada, they brought disease and violence that wiped out 1.9 million Indigenous people with a few centuries.
For treaties, so colonizers established their own government, known as the Crown, and created treaties that Indigenous leaders were deceived to sign over the years. The ulterior motive behind these treaties is that they were created to gain control over the Indigenous population. When signing them, Indigenous leaders believed that they were going to share the land peacefully and receive security. They received neither.
It's just like, to me, it's just sad, like, they just got manipulated. Like, imagine if that happened today. Imagine if, like, a country, like, just deceived someone, like, took all their land, did this. Yeah. There would be, like, a whole, like, problem with, like, United Nations and stuff. Everyone would get into it. And, like, back then, they just couldn't do anything, which I find.
That's a really good word to use, manipulation.
Yeah, no.
It's just unfair.
And but it's crazy because it is still happening in places around the world. It is happening
today that you don't do anything.
Yeah, exactly. So just to add a little bit more.
I feel like it wouldn't be that. Like, it's not as bad, though.
Free Palestine.
Yeah, free Palestine.
But to add a little bit more about the treaties, there were 11 treaties that were created from 1871 to 1921, and those are considered the numbered treaties. But obviously, there were many more that were created, and there are treaties in Canada that the government recognizes, but there are possibly more, and those were signed between 1701 and 1923. So Treaty 3 and Treaty 9 from the numbered treaties cover most of present-day Ontario, and Treaty 13 specifically covers Toronto. So Treaty 3 and 9 were basically an agreement to share the land in exchange for resources from the Indigenous people, and Treaty 13 is called the Toronto Purchase Treaty, and the Toronto Purchase was the surrender of lands in the Toronto area from the Mississaugas of the New Credit to the British Crown. So the initial disputed agreement was made in 1787 and was about the exchange for various items. And then the agreement was revisited in 1805 and was to clarify that they actually purchased the land that is Toronto today. So like Samir said, the treaties were dubious and they forced Indigenous people to agree to them, and they were mostly like take it or leave it documents, and most importantly, there was never a complete understanding of what the treaties actually stated because of language barriers between the two parties. And so sometimes members of the Crown would literally hold the hands of Indigenous people and like force them to sign the treaties, and they came up with like really inhumane strategies to initiate the signings. For example, Treaty 6 was to move Indigenous people off the land as fast as possible to begin the construction of the Canadian Pacific Railway. And so what the Crown did was they used the circumstances of famine as leverage against the Indigenous people, and they only gave out emergency rations to those who signed the treaty. And even after signing, many people didn't receive the food that they were promised and passed away from starvation. And so there are obviously so many other governmental attempts by the Crown. The Indian Act in 1876 contained several laws that targeted Indigenous people and obviously increased the privilege of settlers. So the Indian Act said that if Indigenous people were to complete a university degree, voted, served in the military, became a lawyer, or married a non-Indigenous person, they could lose their Indian status or Indigenous status. Residential schools obviously became compulsory for Indigenous children, and they were stripped of their identities and cultures, and parents were obviously misinformed, again, because of language barriers, but also because they were lied to. Indigenous women were forcefully sterilized so that they could not have more Indigenous children. And the 60s scoop also happened, where child welfare authorities were allowed to take or literally scoop up Indigenous children from their families and put them into foster homes where they would be adopted by white families. And there's honestly so much more that has happened, and it very much affects present day.
Yeah. And, you know, when you look at the information we've presented so far, you think, oh, you know, that's history. That happened a long time ago. You know, it's not that bad anymore. False. When you look at the way the history has shaped modern society, society is built in a way that oppresses and pushes the indigenous people to the bottom and to the side and marginalizes them. And I have some numbers to back this up as well. On average, an indigenous person will make 25% less than a settler in Canada. And when you live under a capitalist system and your whole demographic makes less money, obviously that puts you at an extreme disadvantage. Additionally, in provincial and territorial correctional services, indigenous people make up 26% of admissions, but only make up 3% of the Canadian adult population. The overrepresentation of indigenous people in our prisons is disgusting to me, and is only says more about the way the system is set up and how we can move forward with criminal justice. Additionally, suicide rates are 5 to 7 times higher for indigenous youth than for settler youth. To be more specific, for Inuit youth, the suicide rate is 11 times that of the national average. Actually, as of June 16, 2021, there are 51 long-term drinking water advisories across 32 indigenous communities. In an OECD nation like Canada, that is generally seen as a first world country with very, you know, rich, nice infrastructure, the fact that there are 32 different communities across Canada that don't have clean drinking water is one of the most disgusting things. And what we've seen recently from the press is a reluctance to even admit that. I remember I saw a clip of the NDP federal leader Jagmeet Singh saying that he would, if elected, send money to make the water, and he was being criticized by reporters asking, you know, isn't that just throwing money at it? Wouldn't that really work? When it's water, like, yeah, you need that to live.
It's literally a basic human right.
It's water, bro. Additionally, a large amount of indigenous communities face really high amounts of inadequate housing. A UN report from 2019 found that indigenous people, quote, are more likely to suffer inadequate housing and negative health outcomes as a result. Additionally, indigenous women, there is a disproportionate amount of indigenous women who are found murdered or go missing. And there have been many cases missing and turned up, passed away, and the colonial police force in the area has said there's no foul play, and they're the only people who have said there's no foul play. Every lawyer, every family of the victim have completely rejected that. Additionally, you can look at police brutality. Often when we think about police brutality, we immediately look at the psychotic nature of American policing. But the RCMP in Canada have for generations been an oppressive, controlling rule over indigenous communities. I think it was a couple months ago, or maybe a year ago, my process of time is difficult. But I think a year ago when an indigenous chief got kicked in the face by an RCMP officer. But yeah, I say all this to say that when you look at the legacy and the history of colonialism, it didn't end. It hasn't ended, and it's still going.
Yeah, for sure. And that everything we just said was pretty much just surface level. There's so much more that goes on, but we're going to be touching more on that in our interviews, which will be after our music break. And we're going to be playing a song called Remember Me by an Indigenous artist named Fawn Wood.
Remember me,
remember me,
when the sun comes up in the morning sky, there I will be,
there I will be,
soaring with the eagle so high, feeling free. Remember me, down the road, hand in hand, you and me. Hey oh, hey oh, hey oh.
Hello, hey.
Hey, we
are
hey, oh, hey. Hey, we are hey, oh, hey. Hey, oh, hey, oh.
Remember me. So again, that was Remember Me by Fawn Wood. And so our first guest is the MPP for Toronto Centre. She's the first woman with Indigenous ancestry to be elected to Queen's Park. Ladies and gentlemen, Suze Morrison.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Happy to be here.
Awesome.
Thank you for joining. Okay, so we're just going to jump right into the interview questions. With Canada being a country that's built on the attempted genocide of Indigenous people, do you personally recognize Canada as a legitimate country, and why or why not?
That's a tough question to answer. you know, I think, you know, when I think about what reconciliation means, you know, it's about Canada recognizing that Canada as a country recognizing that it wouldn't exist without the context of genocide, and that it wasn't just a historical moment of time in the past, that there are, you know, ongoing attempts to suppress and erase Indigenous cultures and identities that we're still seeing today, whether that's through the legacy of residential schools, but also the continued removal of children through through CAS, through the Millennial Scoop. You know, there's more children in care right now than there were at the height of the residential school system. And I think that, you know, for settlers and Indigenous people to chart a path forward, that together, that there has to be that work of reconciliation needs to be front and center in a way that, you know, not just governments need to account for, but, you know, everyday people and settlers across the country.
Right. I think you hit the nail on the head. I think real social change comes both on a personal level and on a systemic legislative level in most cases.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, when you look at the TRC, right? Like, there's, you know, when you look to the calls to action in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission report, you know, there's pieces in that report that, you know, every sector and every person can take accountability for. You know, I think a lot of the time, you know, we think of, you know, these reports and recommendations that come out, and we think of those as having, you know, sole ownership within, you know, different levels of government. And I think what's really interesting about, you know, the TRC report is that, you know, there's calls to action for universities, for the healthcare sector, for businesses, you know, for individual people. There's pieces that folks can take responsibility for, whether, you know, in their professional roles or their community roles, or, you know, just as individual settlers. And I think that's important to remember, right? It's, yes, there are calls to action that, you know, the different levels of government are responsible for implementing. But there's pieces in there for everyone to take, accountability for.
Yeah. It's something that I think about often when you think about something like climate justice, where, you know, in my opinion, the vast majority of issues that stem from climate change come from fossil fuels and things from corporations that we don't really have control over. But at the same time, I try to use, like, metal straws just because it's the least I can do, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, it's both, right? It's, you know, systemic change and accountability at government levels and, you know, individual responsibilities as well.
For sure.
Okay, so for our next question, Sorry, this is Samir, by the way. Our next question is, so you're also affiliated with the Coalition to Stop Violence Against Native Women. What would you say are some structural solutions to the issue?
Yeah, so at Queen's Park, so I'm the official opposition critic with the NDP for missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. So it's basically my role at Queen's Park to hold the government, the Conservative government, accountable on their work on that file. And I think, you know, there's a lot to unpack when we talk about violence against Indigenous women and how to end it. And a lot of those pieces are structural and systemic. Yeah, you know, for sure. It's the legacy of residential schools. It's high levels of poverty that are putting women at increased risk of violence. You know, I think that poverty piece can't be understated, but it's also, you know, systemic racism. You know, when Indigenous women are making, you know, 50 cents on the dollar, you know, compared to non-Indigenous men, you know, it's that wage gap is substantial. It's access to services and supports. It's, you know, there's a lot of pieces that are going on there. And, you know, the work to ensure that, you know, communities are safe for Indigenous women, and they're not right now. You know, there's a lot of work that needs to be done there. You know, I don't know that there are quick and easy solutions that, you know, a magic wand that we could wave that would mean every Indigenous woman in the country would be, you know, safe to live and work and go about their lives tomorrow. But there's a lot of things we could be doing. I mean, yeah. You know, we could be making sure that there's clean drinking water in every community. You know, that there's access to safe, affordable housing. You know, proper income supports, childcare. You know, all of these things that aren't just you know, at the end of the day, are good social programs for all women, but especially Indigenous women, to make sure that they're safe and supported in our communities. But it's not a small amount of work, for sure.
No, you are speaking my language right now. this is my faith. Yeah, I because you said, and now I'm really curious. Do you believe housing is a human right?
Absolutely, I do.
Absolutely.
My very, very first motion that I passed in the legislature in 2018 after being elected was a motion to declare housing a human right and to call on the Conservative government to make more investments provincially in subsidized housing and to address the capital repair backlog in social housing.
Right.
And I was able to get that motion passed in 2018, but we unfortunately haven't seen the Conservative government actually honor and implement that motion to date.
Yeah, which I'm not too surprised about.
But no.
I'm also curious, with you being the representative for Toronto Centre, with Toronto Centre being such a diverse, immigrant-heavy area, for you being the elected official and an Indigenous person, what do you think are, whether it's the easy, the hardest, what are ways that we can show solidarity to actually help and reverse the long-lasting effects of colonization and, I guess, help to decolonize in some way?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one big step is education. You know, I think, you know, one of the criticisms I certainly have of, you know, all levels of government historically is that the history of Canada and the history of the genocide that has happened in this country is not adequately taught in either our public education system or to folks that are coming to Canada for the first time, who I think are, you know, marketed a different sort of history internationally of what Canada's relationship is like with Indigenous people here. And I think, you know, as you touch on, you know, a community that's, you know, filled with, you know, a really diverse community with a lot of newcomers, that, you know, a lot of the folks I talk to in the community, especially in Regent Park, you know, as they're immigrating to Canada, they're shocked when they get here, and find out, and start learning about the history. And I think, you know, at different levels of government, you know, especially at the federal level, as they're making those touch points, with folks through the immigration process, there needs to be a better job, to educate, everyone, on the history of colonization in this country, on the TRC, on the calls to justice in the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls Inquiry Report, so that people, the first step is education, right? You know, yeah. People have to know the history of this country in order to take up a sense of, you know, accountability for reconciliation. And that education piece is, I think, sorely lacking. You know, and then when we look at our current provincial government, you know, and their responsibility to fill that education role provincially in our school system, well, what's one of the very first things that Doug Ford did when he was elected in 2018? He canceled planned curriculum writing sessions to include reconciliation in our grade school curriculums. And delayed and interfered with that process so that, you know, kids in school weren't getting that education. And it was just utterly shameful. But I think that the education piece is a really important, tangible first step that, folks can focus on.
Yeah. I remember, I think a week or two ago, I was having a conversation with one of my coworkers, and he was filming the rally on July 1st for, residential mm-hmm. schools. And he said he saw a lot of immigrant Canadians kind of like counter-protesting, because to them, the Canada they were sold was a one of independence, one of yeah. freedom, one of mm-hmm. democracy. And it's this weird sort of dichotomy where there's like blood covered in like red paint, like nice red paint. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I mean, like I said, it's an education piece, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's for newcomers, Canada represents, you know, hope and you know, a sense of a strong future for their families. And a lot of folks in our community are coming from places that are deep in conflict. Mm-hmm. And so they see Canada as, you know, a peaceful place that's, you know, a refuge to raise their families. And it can be hard when, you know, you've only ever been taught one side of a country's history. Mm-hmm. And to come face to face with, you know, a conflicting history of what actually happened in Canada, and that can be really jarring for folks to come to terms with, particularly if they're coming from places that have experienced genocide themselves or conflict or war, and to think that, you know, you've come someplace to be free of those things, only to have to come face to face with Canada's genocide. It can be very difficult. Yeah.
The propaganda machine is powerful. I'll say that.
Yeah, and that's why the education piece is so important, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, you are someone with Indigenous ancestry. So, what are some Indigenous like traditional values that you live by?
Yeah. So, my family is mixed. So I identify both as Indigenous and settler, and we have two generations of foster care in my family. So it's been pretty difficult for my family to, you know, really make those connections to culture and community over the years, as we've tried to kind of piece together, you know, a place and reclaim teachings and things like that. You know, I've been really lucky through the urban Indigenous community to have access to things like, you know, elders and ceremony to help take up some of those teachings. And it, you know, it's been wonderful. And, I think I'm really grateful to, you know, the urban Indigenous communities and specifically the friendship centers like Council Fire, which is, you know, right here in Regent Park for us,
yeah.
That are doing that work of supporting urban Indigenous people in our community every day, because it can be difficult to make been, you know, displaced or, you know, separated from family and culture and community. For the Friendship Centers and the Urban Indigenous organizations that are supporting folks in our community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And that kind of leads us into our last question. So you're the first woman with Indigenous ancestry in Queens Park. So what does that mean to you?
Yeah, it's interesting. I really actually struggle with that, kind of wearing that hat, as someone who is mixed. And, it's representation is so, so, so important. And Queens Park and public offices at all levels of government have historically been very male.
Yeah.
And very white and very straight and very cisgendered and all of those things. And, the fact that in 2021, we're still marking firsts in our legislature, that we're still marking firsts in our public offices for, identities and communities to be represented for the first time is a little bit heartbreaking to me. But it's so important. People need to see themselves represented in their government.
Yeah.
And the fact that, in 2021, we still don't have gender parity in the provincial legislature, that, we only have out of 124 members, three who are Indigenous, three who identify as queer. We have a long way to go in to ensure that our legislatures look like the people that they represent.
Yeah, 100%.
And like the communities that they represent. So it's constantly, pushing those boundaries, and also, making sure that, we're doing the work as parties to make sure that, come next election, right, that we've, identified and supported the candidates to, in other ridings, to start putting their names on ballots and running, so that we can continue to increase the diversity of the legislature. It's not a small amount of. It's not just about people from different communities, not necessarily not self-selecting to run for public office. It's that there are systemic barriers in place that make it even harder for them, and whether that's economic opportunities or access to, a depth of connections to fundraise from, or national experience level, things like that. It's supporting, is it for women who don't have access to childcare, things like that. It's how are you supporting the next generation of candidates to overcome those systemic barriers that make it even harder for them to run for office, so that we can get a legislature that actually reflects the diversity of our communities.
Yeah,
100%. So that wraps up the interview. Thank you for making the time to talk with us today.
Yeah, and thank you for having me. It's been
no
a pleasure.
No problem.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
Okay, thank you so much.
Yeah.
Bye.
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 Everybody, that was Suze Morrison, an MPP for Toronto Centre. We're going to take a short music break before our second interview.
Do you speak? Do you speak on this land? This is Indian land. Do you speak? Do you speak on this land? This is our home on native land. Do you speak? Do you speak on this land? This is stolen land, occupied land, land under siege. Do you speak? Do you speak foot to ground above our burial mounds? Do you speak? Do you speak broken treaties, broken promises, breaking spirits? Do you speak? Do you speak white noise? Static. So sterile is sterilizing the natural flow of our blood memory, like receding ice caps from oceans to seas, to rivers, to brooks, to creeks. Do you speak or do you leak? False truths, like pipelines built in 1952, spewing toxins so poisonous, it's altering our social consciousness. Do you speak? Do you feel before you speak, or do you think before you speak? because the heart should lead the head. But instead, your head leads your heart. That's why when you speak, things fall apart. Do you speak? Nah. You just talk a whole bunch of shit. And for centuries and centuries and centuries, you've been fertilizing it. Well, tonight, I'm not going to speak. I'm going to teach. I'm not going to speak. I'm going to preach. I'm not going to speak. I'm going to reach back 7 generations into my ancestral legacy because I come from a people who don't speak. We are speak. We be that crazy, sexy.
Okay, so that was a little bit of spoken word for our break, and that was Malaika, who is actually our next guest. She is a spoken word artist, arts educator, eco-influencer, public speaker, and performance artist. She's so many things. Malaika.
More than 500
hey,
years of colonial
time.
Hi.
Can you hear us?
Hello?
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 Hi.
Hi.
All right, can you hear us?
Hey.
Hey.
I can hear you, yeah.
Awesome.
Okay.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, we're excited to have you as well.
So we just want to introduce ourselves before, because sometimes we forget to do that. So my name is Simon.
Okay, cool.
My name is Samir.
My name is Dayum.
And my name is Rebel.
So, yeah, thank you for
There's a lot of y'all.
Yeah, there's 4 of us. There's 4 of us.
Okay.
Yeah.
All
so,
right. Cool.
Yeah, so thank you for taking the time to join us today.
Uh-huh, yeah. Like I said, I'm really excited to be here. Sego, Skanangoa, Malaika Wairi, Amaligadha, Kashnaskwe, Yonkiat, Haudenosaunee, Mi'kmaq First Nations, Wagaho Oswego Titarando. So hello.
So to start things off, to everybody who's listening, tell us a little bit about yourself. What's your story?
I don't really want to talk about myself, actually. I kind of more want to talk about the work and all of those good things, and obviously my relationship to Region Park and the center to kind of start things off.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
So should we just get to the second question then?
Yeah, we should. So, let's just move on. So we know that you work with the Center of Learning and Development here in Region Park. So, what do you like about your work, and what do you like about working here?
Well, even before I became a part of the team at CLND, I have so many memories as a youth and an emerging artist engaging in like community events and like delivering arts-based workshops at like Lord Dufferin Public School.
Oh, yeah.
So I really like enjoy the people, you know, of Regent Park. That's what makes it home to me. Mm-hmm. And they're like an extended family. And I've had so many like positive co-creating experiences with amazing programs and partnerships over the years. I even hosted a radio show on Radio Regent called One Voice Radio from like 2012 to like 2016. And I just love the growth of the social enterprises that we support at the center, like the Regent Park Catering Collective, the Sewing Studio.
Yeah.
And we are currently offering, our first virtual summer youth camp. So this youth camp basically is for youth ages 15 to 19 who live in Regent Park, St. Jamestown, or Moss Park. Mm-hmm. And it actually is starting next week. So registration ends at the end of this week, I believe July 25th. So anyone who's interested, I would say check out our IG because the flyer information is there. And I'll leave the handle with y'all. It is at Toronto CLD. So at Toronto CLD, and you can get all your information on how to enroll. There's going to be like workshops around like mental health, social media impact, online safety, mentorship for those who are looking for more supports as they're moving into post-secondary, and just able to increase, you know, your personal network as a young person. So yeah, I love Regent.
Thank you so much for that. I've made a mental note of it.
Yeah.
And okay, I think awesome.
What you were saying earlier, we were talking about last week too, where the thing with Regent Park is that once you get involved with the community, it really does feel like an extended family.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, like, I'm originally sort of like a Scarborough, Scartown person, and but I've never felt like Regent Park wasn't home to me as a youth, as an adult. I've been there.
Just to move on, we also know that you're an activist and you support a lot of abolition movements here in Toronto. As an Afro-Indigenous person, how has your life and your identity influenced your feelings on things like policing?
Well, I mean, striving towards disarming and defunding, dismantling the police and the RCMP is a part of the legacy, essentially, like, left to me by, you know, both my Black and Indigenous ancestors. State-sanctioned policing polices my body, my communities, my culture on these lands, now known as North America. And we know that policing grew out of the slave patrols, you know, the enforcement of the Jim Crow and segregation laws, controlling Black laborers and Black bodies. The Northwest Mounted Police was created by Sir John A. Macdonald, who was one of the architects behind residential schools and the Indian Act. And it was through the RCMP that, you know, they stole the children, and they began policing Indigenous mobilities on reserves, stopping us from our hunting, our gathering, our gaming, like all of the things that we did on the land. And they just continue to be tied into all of the things around surveillancing Indigenous and Black, you know, activists, land defenders, water protectors who are trying to, you know, deal with different aspects of social justice and climate justice. Right. And so I always think to myself, like, you know, we need to really re-envision a world without policing, because that's the world our ancestors came from. There were no cops here.
Yeah, exactly,
so,
exactly.
You know, if we did it once, why can't we do it again? Like, really, that's kind of what I think.
I think when you touch on that, it really touches on a lot of things where you look at, you know, people will say, oh, humans are just bad for the environment. We always destroy things.
But
that's
thing. Yeah, exactly.
That's a Western thing. I mean, of course, a European thing, you know? And I think also, there's a sort of colonial apathy towards other people that creates environments where crime happens in the first place. And rather than preventing it, it's sort of a reactionary policing of it and putting people in cages, which, frankly, hasn't worked yet.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, when you think of the statistics, even that, like, the total RCMP planned gross spending for, like, last year was $5.1 billion, and 60% of that was used on Indigenous people, like, basically policing our bodies. Yeah. And then here in Toronto, or Tikarondo, we know, like, the average homeowner is contributing, like, over $700 in taxes to police services, and yet only maybe a little over 100 is going towards shelter supports and housing, and like over $60 is going towards employment and social services. So right away you can see like how capitalism helps to uphold these systems of colonial violence.
I agree 1,000%.
The ratios just don't make sense. So a question, so you obviously do a lot of artwork and performing. So what parts of your cultural identity do you like to translate into your work?
I find that an interesting question, because I honestly don't think that, for me personally, I make it a point to do that. I am who I am, and I be who I be. So it's like art is like an extension of life. Like art is life. Life is art for the cultures that I come from. So I'm just being me, and all parts. I bring my whole self into my art. And so I just reflect the parts of me that are me. And whether it's through music, whether it's through visual art, digital art, writing, spoken word, or medicine keeping. You know, it's all an expression of all of those aspects of who I be.
I agree totally. I'm a writer and sort of like an aspiring filmmaker, and anytime I'm writing a script or something, I don't really think about it as writing. I think about just grabbing, I guess, just the feelings around me and just putting it into a paper, you know?
Absolutely. Like, just really channeling, you know, your present experiences, you know, wisdoms from the past. And also the way forward, because I work a lot in futurism. So I'm really, like, interested in, you know, creating worlds that I want to see exist, especially where my Black and Indigenous kin are concerned, where we are no longer just surviving, but we are thriving.
So we often hear land back as a proposed solution to the generations of oppression, but I feel as though a lot of people don't really know what it means. If you had to explain it to someone new to the concept, how would you do it?
Okay, so I've been doing this a lot. So, first of all, we are the land.
Okay.
Land back acknowledges the fact that we are the land. So when we talk about land back, we're talking about getting back to ourselves. In the Ganyangahaga language, we say, like, aguego agua da ongwe, which means all my relations. So the idea of land back is really getting back to our roles and responsibilities as stewards to these lands, the reciprocity in relationship with land and water and all our relations for generations. You know, colonization brought and forced an ideology that the purpose of land and water is to be mined, extracted, used, owned, commodified for profit, which is like counter to like the Ongwe Omwe Nea, the indigenous ways of knowing and being. Furthermore, there is no land back without indigenous sovereignty and Black liberation, period. You know, we make up, as indigenous peoples, less than 5% of the world's population, and yet we defend almost 90% of the world's global diversity. So land back is also climate justice. And there can be no climate justice without indigenous rights being honored, especially access to clean water. And we know, you know, as of May 2018, there were 174 drinking water advisories in over 100 First Nations communities. And what that means is that a single drinking water advisory has over 5,000 people lacking access to clean and safe water. And Trudeau got elected and reelected on promises of ending the drinking water advisories by 2021. And that has still not happened. Land back is our water protectors, our land defenders. Land back is First Nations and tribal communities across Turtle Island engaging in conservation easement abolition work. What does that mean? It means that we should be the ones who are leading heritage parks, waterways, heritage trails, wildlife ranges and reserves, because that's on our land. It's about buying back ancestral lands and sacred sites if need be. It's about preserving our heritage seeds by returning them to the soils of the original seed keepers and territories. It's about returning land to us. It's about paying rent back. If you own a home on stolen land, you need to think about the implications of your investment in the ongoing colonial project. So how can you begin to think about ownership in a more re-indigenized way? So looking at rent back, looking at cottage country and vacation homes being accessible to indigenous land defenders and water protectors who are exhausted and need some time off. You know, can you give them a couple of weeks in your vacation home or your cottage for free to do that? You know, our ancestors paid for the land over and over and over again with their blood, with their lives. So it's not a sale. when we're buying back our land, it's like it's already been paid for by those who are no longer here. So there are many facets to this, but yeah. at the end of the day, it is rooted in the fact that we are the land. Done.
Wow, thank you.
Yeah. Well said, well said. So for our next question, it's what are some traditional cultural practices that you perform?
I'm actually not going to answer that question because I think that that question's problematic. I'm sure it was meant in a good way, but it's like I'm an urban present day individual. And I think my cultural practices for the most part are for me to do. Mm-hmm. And if for those who might be interested in learning, that's like a whole other process that I don't think this medium facilitates.
Okay, we'll talk about that. But although I am very curious, you've talked a lot about, you know, how much work everything you're saying is and how necessary that work is. But, you know, constant advocacy can be just as tiresome as it is rewarding. So what are some things you do to just de-stress when things just are a lot?
I have a poem that I wrote recently, and there's a line in there that says, rest is resiliency, energy is our currency. And so for me, I think it's really important as activists that we understand that rest is integral to the revolution. And that means I have to say no to things. I have to remember that the word responsibility actually means what I am capable of responding to. I have to protect my energy, and that means I have to set healthy boundaries. I have to be able to integrate, you know, wellness practice into my advocacy, whatever that looks like, depending on the situation. It could be, you know, just being still and silent. It could be making sure I'm getting enough sleep. It could be getting on the land and being in nature. It could be drinking my herbal medicines or smudging or, you know, engaging in ceremony. It could be taking a long, hot bubble bath. It could be engaging with my plant babies or also just unplugging from, like, social media. And remembering to breathe. I think that that's really, really important. I'm actually in currently in a 6-week mindfulness course, which I think has been really helpful to me because I've been able to integrate some of those practices into my daily life. But also, I can't wait to be able to share them with other, you know, folks who are in leadership or in activism or transformative justice work. As well. So I'm doing that training right now as we speak. So yeah, it's really important. Rest is resiliency, and definitely energy is our currency.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to remember that because you have to make sure that you take care of yourself or you're going to get burnt out, and that won't be beneficial for anyone. But
absolutely not.
Yeah. So unfortunately, that's all the time that we have today because we only have until 1 o'clock. But thank you so much for your time and joining us today. We learned so much.
Yeah.
Oh, Nyawagoa, big thanks, Wolomtik, to all y'all on Radio Region. It was so cool to be back on the airwaves.
Yeah, it's a full circle
Radio
moment.
Region.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for having me.
No problem. Thank you.
Onagiwai.
Yep.
Bye.
Okay, so everybody, that was our second radio show. How was that, everyone?
I liked it. It was fun.
That was really fun.
It was very informative. We learned a lot.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't get trapped with a liberal politician. I mean,
But anyway, make sure to tune in next week, Monday, same time, same place.